I'm getting my little office set up here. If you would get your Bible out. So you can use those good old-fashioned paper Bibles that always work and never crash. Or you might access God's Word through a tablet or through YouVersion, and you can follow along in YouVersion if you're using that app. I'll click under the Events tab, and you can just follow along and also get some additional resources there. But I do want you in God's Word, because we're going to be hearing a story from the book of Daniel. So see if you can find Daniel. There's never any shame in going to the table of contents first. But the book of Daniel from chapter 2. Now, as we pick up the story, this is a story of the nation of Israel in an incredibly, incredibly difficult time. See, they have been taken into exile from Jerusalem over there on the left side circle to the nation of Babylonia, in particular Babylon, circled over there on the right, about a 300-400 mile journey. And for them, there could be no more humbling destination. See, I don't know if you remember this part, but see, way back when the nation of Israel was initially formed, as God called to Abraham, he called to Abraham in the land of Ur, the land of the Chaldeans, the land of Babylon, and told Abraham that he would give him a land and he would bless his offspring. And so over those next hundreds of years, the nation of Israel was established over in the land that God promised. But because the nation had forsaken God, God humbled them in the most profound way possible. They not only lost the land, but they went right back to where they started. This is like you're 53 years old, unemployed, recently divorced, living in your parents' basement, sleeping in your childhood bed with the Star Wars sheets. I mean, you're like, how did I get here? They are right back to square one. And they are in a position where they are being confronted by all of the values of the kingdom of Babylon. A kingdom, and I don't know if you can imagine this, but this was a culture that was obsessed with youth and beauty and talent. Can you imagine that? A culture that would tell people, you know, you can be anything you want to be. And, you know, and God, especially a God that oversees everything, is irrelevant to the conversation. Now, they did have gods that would help them out with particular things, household idols, that kind of thing. But the creed of Babylon was make yourself great. And here in this greatest empire at this point ever known to man, was a king, King Nebuchadnezzar. If you're a history buff, technically he's Nebuchadnezzar II. But he had amassed more power and more centralized power than any other human being in history. And to a certain degree, more than every human being ever since. His word was law. I mean, there's no court of appeal. There's no check and balance. There's no house, no senate. There's no Supreme Court. There's just Nebuchadnezzar. And whatever he says goes. And, excuse me. Oh, that didn't go so well. Anyway, so he has brought in some of the best and the brightest from the nation of Israel. It's kind of this brain drain from Israel and all of the other nations that he has conquered, bringing them into the royal courts so that he can have the best advice possible so that the kingdom can continue to flourish. It's a brilliant political move, but incredibly difficult for the four characters that we are following in the book of Daniel. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. And as we learned last week, as they're coming into the courts, as they are being inundated with all of the Babylonian culture and all the Babylonian expectations, as they are being inundated with all of the opulence of the throne room, they are being offered the very best of the best of the best. And Daniel, Mishael, Azariah, Hananiah, they are learning that they need to push back against the cultural influence. And that's even one of the themes that we're looking at throughout the series. You don't have to swallow everything. They and we live in a cultural stream that tells us why we matter, what we're supposed to think about, how we measure success. And you and I, we don't have to swallow everything we're given. The Babylonian Empire sought to give them new names. And while they worked with those new names, they never forgot their old ones. An important word for us. But as we pick up the story, we realize that even though they have been brought into the hallways of power, they've been brought into the king's court with the great privilege that they're enjoying there. I mean, they have access to everything. With that great privilege also comes great pressure. And so just as we start into the story, I'd like you to be thinking about where is an area in your life where you're feeling pressure. Because in this story and in our lives, we have to figure out how we deal with the pressure. And where do we go when we're under pressure? Who do we lean on when we're under pressure, and why? It's also helpful for us to be thinking about, because with great privilege comes great pressure, we need to be real careful as we envy those in positions perhaps higher than us. You know, we think, oh, wouldn't it be great if I was like her and I was manager of the entire, you know, region? Wouldn't it be great if I was like him and I had all that responsibility? It must be so awesome. And we forget that often those who have those positions of privilege have paid a tremendous price to be there, because with great privilege always comes great pressure. Now we're going to see the pressure that Daniel and his friends are under. Let's open up the word. Okay, you ready? This is a crazy, crazy, amazing, good story. So Daniel chapter 2, starting with verse 1. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. You don't want to have a maniacal world dictator that is sleep deprived. You can write that down. It's bad. Kings should always get their beauty rest, but Nebuchadnezzar was getting none of it. He was having one of those dreams that was just so weird. He knew it was important. He just couldn't figure out what it was. He was like, it was a reoccurring dream/nightmare. And so the king, he summoned the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, the astrologers, all the wise people to tell him what he had dreamed. This is where it gets interesting. So when they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, I had a dream. Not like Martin Luther King, like this is a bad one. I had a dream that troubles me and I want to know what it means. Then the astrologers, they answered the king, may the king live forever. Remember, if you're talking to a maniacal world, you know, dictator, be polite, because, you know, the people die. Okay, may the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we'll interpret it. That wasn't what he was asking, though, was it? He wants to know what the dream was. No, just tell us the dream. And then, you know, we'll wave our sticks around and we'll do a little dance and throw out some little potion stuff. And then we'll tell you what it means. I've never done this, but I've always been tempted. You know how, I mean, we even have a few of these in downtown Wenatchee, but, you know, into the big cities where you go downtown, there's all these different kind of palm readers and psychics and things like that. I've been so tempted. I don't know if I'd ever get the guts to do this. But to go into one of those places, and of course they're going to ask, so why are you here? And I would say, well, you tell me. And if they can't, you know, because of course they can't tell you. The whole thing's a sham. Of course it is. But Nebuchadnezzar, he's pushing the astrologers, the magicians, the enchanters. He's pushing them to their limits and revealing that they don't actually know as much about the unknown as they've claimed to be, or claimed to know. All right, so let's pick it up. So the king replied to the astrologers, this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you'll receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and then interpret it for me. And you thought you had a bad work environment. So, yeah, anyways, life and death. So once more, they replied, this time, I'm assuming here, quaking in their boots, they replied, let the king, how about you just tell the servants the dream and then we'll interpret it. The king would have nothing of that. Then the king answered, I am certain that you are trying to gain time because you realize this is what I firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is only one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream. Then I will know that you can interpret it for me. One of the things that some scholars have suggested about this this passage is, see, Nebuchadnezzar actually inherited the kingdom from his dad. Now, he was a military leader, so he wasn't a guy without any, political prowess, but it's an inherited kingdom, and he inherited a lot of the wise men. So he's testing them. Do they really have the insights that they claim to have? Are they really as supernaturally dialed in as they claim? And the answer is no. The astrologers answered the king, "There is no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans." This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death. And men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. Now, was Daniel part of the enchanter magician crew? No, but he was part of the king's court. He was one of those wise men. He wasn't making the same claims that they were making. He wasn't trying to gain knowledge by the same means that they were at least faking the ability to gain knowledge, but he is still lumped in with them. See, Nebuchadnezzar hasn't really figured out the difference. They're just all of them scoundrels, off with their heads. Pretty bad. And so Daniel is experiencing a tremendous amount of pressure, and it's not even his fault. He didn't ask to be here. He was taken into Babylon against his wishes. He's smart and yeah, he's wise, but he's basically a slave. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you're catching all the heat, all the blame? You had nothing to do with it. Pressure, isn't it? So what do I do? Where do I turn? Now what? When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with, here's where it gets interesting, wisdom and tact. Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. Pressure reveals character. And Daniel, under pressure, he responded with wisdom and tact. You might want to even, if you got a pen out, you might even want to underline that. That's one of the things that is a characteristic of people who have been walking with the Lord. People who are secure in their faith, who knows that there's a God in heaven, they can respond even in stressful situations with wisdom and tact. Often at times it helps to keep your head intact when you've got a maniacal dictator that's looking to kill you, but you respond with wisdom and tact. And he asked the king's officer, "Why does the king issue such a harsh decree?" Arioch explained the matter to Daniel, and at this, Daniel went into the king and asked for times so that he might interpret the dream for him. That gets to the second big point. I already mentioned it a little bit, but it's this, that pressure reveals character. You want to know who a person is? You watch how they behave when life is going wrong for them, when things aren't going as planned for them. Where do they turn for comfort? Where do they turn for wisdom? Where do they turn for strength? Because, see, if this God thing, we've just sung about all these little songs and how great you are, and God, if it's just like an inspirational message, like, unicorns and garden gnomes, and it's really wonderful, but, it kind of makes you feel better, like cute kitten memes on a bad day. But that's really all it is. If faith is kind of like the same thing that we often hear about in culture, where it's like faith, it's a private thing, and you find your own inspiration, but don't really bring this whole God thing into the public forum. I mean, we don't really talk about right and wrong. What we talk about is what's right and wrong for you and for me. I mean, if this God thing is just pleasant speech, a wonderful story that makes us feel good, then when we reach a situation that cannot be solved with human wisdom or with human work ethic, we freak out. We've got nothing to draw from. We got nowhere to go. I mean, you're just hosed, man. You got nothing. Or if this God thing, the thing that we sing about, and if it's real, I mean, if it's real, it changes everything. And we see in Daniel's response, I mean, there's no way he doesn't have an answer to this. He doesn't know how to tell the king what he just dreamt or how to interpret it. There's no way that with as smart as he is, as privileged as he is, there's no way he can figure it out. But he knows that there is one who can. And we see that in his response to the king. That's why he responds with wisdom intact, even under immense, immense pressure. And then we see what he does next. So then Daniel returned to the house, and he explained the matter to his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Guys, we got to pray. And that's what they did. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. It's a very specific prayer request. And during the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, "Praise be the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises up others. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells in him. I thank you and praise you, God of my ancestors. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you, and you have made known to us the dream of the king." Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and he said to him, "Don't execute the wise men of Babylon. No, take me to the king. I will interpret his dream for him." Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, "I found a man among the exiles of Judah who can tell the king what his dream means." Then the king asked Daniel, also called Belshazzar, that was the Babylonian name they'd given him, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" Daniel replied, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. There is no consultant that can figure out our business's problem, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. There is no counselor so smart that they can untangle the relationship mess we've gotten ourselves into right now, dear, but there is a God who reveals mysteries. There's no parenting book that can tell me how to help my teenager make it through this incredibly trying situation. I have no idea what to do, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries." Am I talking to anybody today? You know, what's the area where you're feeling pressure? He has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the days to come. Your dream and the vision that passed through your mind as you were lying in bed are these. As your majesty was lying there, your mind turned to things to come, and the revealer of mysteries showed you what is going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because I have greater wisdom than anyone else alive, but so that your majesty may know the interpretation and that you may understand what went through your mind. Who's Daniel, just quick pause, who's Daniel giving the credit to? "Your majesty looked, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partially of iron, partially of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, not by human hands. It struck the statue on the feet of iron and clay and smashed them. And then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all broken to pieces and became like chaff on the threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream, and now we will interpret it to the king. Your Majesty, you are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed all mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold. After you, another kingdom will arise, inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partially of baked clay, partially of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. As the toes were partially iron, partially clay, so this kingdom will be partially strong, partially brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it itself will endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of the mountain, but not by human hands. A rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. Drop the mic. Boom. Let's take a quick look at the dream and Daniel's interpretation, because if we hear this, I think we're going to find ourselves responding in the very same way that Nebuchadnezzar is about to respond. He is about to have his mind blown. This is a passage that was written 2,600 years ago by a God who oversees history, a God outside of time and space, a God who sees the big picture in ways that we never, ever could. And he reveals to this maniacal world leader in a nightmare, in broad brushstrokes, what's about to happen over the next 2,600 years. Let's check this out. Okay, so here's a little artist image of the thing. You remember, you've got this giant statue, and the head is made of gold, and the chest silver, and the thigh, waist, bronze, legs of iron, and then at the very bottom, you've got these toes and iron and clay, and it's kind of mixed. Do you know that since the Babylonian Empire, there have been three other major empires? So just shortly after the Babylonian Empire is the Medo-Persian. It started in roughly 539 BC. I mean, we're going to be looking at that transition of power in just a few weeks. Daniel was alive during that time. And the Medo-Persian Empire, it was a little different in that it had a less centralized power than the Babylonian Empire. And you'll notice that as the vision kind of progresses, the substance of the statue becomes less valuable but stronger. Less valuable but stronger over time. So you have the Medo-Persian Empire from 539 till roughly 331 BC, somewhere in there. And then we have the Grecian Empire. And then after that, starting in about 168 BC, roughly, the Roman Empire. There's two legs to the statue. The Roman Empire, east and west. And do you know that we still, in many ways, live under the influence of the Roman Empire? I mean, diluted, kind of mixed with other ideas, yes. But there has never been another empire like that Roman Empire. You don't believe me? Who here has been to Washington, D.C.? Who's like, or you've seen a picture of the Capitol building or the White House. You could identify. So some of you honestly have never seen the Capitol building or the White House? Really? That's just weird. Okay. Capitol building. The White House. What form of architecture is it? The answer is Roman. What kind of columns? Roman. So in our branches of government, we have the executive branch, we have the House, and we have the... In Rome, what's the governing body? It's called the Senate. That's amazing. Crazy, crazy. Now, some of you were raised Catholic or otherwise known as Roman Catholic. Oh, that's amazing. In Russia, right up until the First World War, about 1918, the major Russian leader was known as the Tsar. The Tsar. The Tsar. Or still we have like a drug czar in our, I mean, it's part of vocabulary. Tsar is a version of the word Caesar. Okay? Again, up until 1918 and about the First World War in Germany, the major leader was called the Kaiser. Also makes a fantastic role, by the way. Kaiser, a variant of the word Caesar, which is Roman. Now, we all love the American eagle, right? The symbol of American strength. Was it originally an American symbol? Answer is no. That's the symbol of power for, guess what nation? Rome. We live as an ongoing extension of the influence of the Roman Empire. So where does that put us on this old statue thing? We kind of have some Roman influences, but kind of not. Who are we? Feet. Connected to the Roman Empire. Influenced by the Roman Empire, but partially Roman, partially other stuff. Now, this dream, this 2,600-year-old dream, what do you think are the odds of God, through Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, describing something? I realize it's fuzzy. I realize it's a vision. But actually describing with tremendous accuracy every empire that would exist from that time until now. What do you think are the odds of that? Now, this vision ends with something. There's a rock coming towards the statue. The cornerstone, if you will. Or I don't know if you remember this from some of the Old Testament stories, but when they would build an altar, they would build an altar made out of uncut rock. Who is the ultimate sacrifice of God? What's the way that we know about the love of God more than any other single event in history? Well, what's his name? Jesus. Whose return are we awaiting? What do you think are the odds that the God who accurately, I mean, 2,600 years ago predicted every other human empire, that he's going to get the last part of this wrong? About the fact that all of these human empires, and we live in one, you have to understand that. All of these human empires, all of them will one day fall. And they will get smashed to bits. They will fade away. They will be blown away like chaff on a threshing room floor. All these kingdoms that we build as humans, they mean something, but not much. Now, I realize that many of us are going to want to go into the fine details of this. I'm not convinced that that's helpful. But there is a big message here that we need to hear. That God has shaped history. And that the things that we're involved in, the empires that are rising and falling around us, ultimately, he's aware of all of it. Ultimately, he's behind all of it. And so as we realize that human kingdoms fall, and God's kingdom is forever, it should bring about in us maybe the same kind of response that Nebuchadnezzar experienced. Because we're just going to finish off the story. We've got like two verses to go. You ready? Then King Nebuchadnezzar, I mean, the most singularly powerful person, perhaps, at least from a political standpoint, ever to have lived, he realized that God was in charge of things, and he fell prostrate. That's like on his face. He fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of kings and the God of gods and the Lord of kings, and is a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." In other words, he got the dream right. Then the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon, placed him in charge of all of its wise men. One little pause. I got to just throw in one little nerdy thing. I just this gets me, okay? So in order for King Nebuchadnezzar to be aware of the God of the Israelites, the God of history, the wise men from Israel would be taken into captivity in Babylon so they could talk to the king. So the king would be aware of the power of God. 600 years later, a really important thing happened in Israel. A king was born. Because the stories of that of the God of the Israelites had embedded themselves in the collective memory of Babylon, there were wise men in Babylon that went to go see the King of Kings. I mean, God understands history. Centuries are nothing to him. Do you think your problem is too big for him? Honestly. Isn't that just crazy? Just crazy. And so at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's the Israelite guys. Administrators over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained at the royal court. So here's my question. We just got to apply it. I'm going to land this one fast. So what is your impossible situation? You know that pressure thing you were thinking about at the beginning of the sermon? What's your impossible situation? You know, chances are the ones that really keep you up at night are the ones that kind of like for the situation that Daniel was facing. They're ones that no amount of human wisdom, and I know many of you are wise, no amount of work ethic, and I know many of you work hard, that no amount of wisdom or hard work can fix. Those are the ones that really keep you up. Am I right? They're the situations at work that you can't solve. They're the relationship challenges you need somebody else's heart to change. And you can't do it. You can't make it happen. It's the political environment that, you do your best, but you have no control over that. The business environment, the financial environment. You do your best, but you have no control over it. Chances are, that's your impossible situation. It's honestly too big for you. But the question is, in that impossible situation, what do you do with it? And this might seem like an obvious question, but it's just straight out of the story. So with your impossible situation, that really big one, like honestly, have you prayed about it? Have you taken it to God? Or did you just get really worked up? Because if God, the whole Jesus thing, church thing, if it's just this inspirational pick-me-up, like the kitten meme or unicorns or garden gnomes, then of course you're going to get worked up. Because you've got nowhere to go. You can't just inspire yourself out of this problem. But if there really is a God who oversees history, where millennium of human history can be revealed in a weird dream, Like if there's a God who understands history to that degree, then at the very moment that you and I, we find ourselves at the end of our rope, we are just at the very beginning of God's resources. Does anybody out there hear me? When we're at the end of our rope, you're just starting with God's capacity. So give him your big one. Give him your big challenge. It's not so hard to him. Now, that doesn't mean that he's going to do exactly what we want. I mean, he doesn't work for us. He loves us very much, but he doesn't take orders from you. We need to take orders from him, but we can give our problems over to him, and he can do things with them that go so far beyond what we could ever ask or imagine. So have you prayed about it? Have you prayed about it with anybody else? Because remember this whole Daniel story. It's, you know, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. They are talking about it together. You show me the lone Christian, I'll show you a lonely Christian. You show me a lone Christian, I'll show you a Christian who's at risk. You show me a lone Christian, I'll show you a Christian who can do a few things, but pretty soon is going to end up at the end of their resources. You've only got so much faith. I realize you're pretty smart. I realize you're pretty faithful. But if it's just you and you're not praying about it with anybody, you're going to hit your limit pretty fast. Daniel prayed about it with other people. Now, whether that means for you a connection group, like, I mean, most people in the church, we found the group now. It's pretty cool. I love that. We also have groups that are off the grid. I realize some of you, you're not going to join anything, but you can do something. You can figure it out on your own. I mean, just grab some friends, go to coffee, talk about your life, pray together. You don't even need to tell us. It's awesome. I mean, you can go like totally rogue connection group, you know. That's fine. That's fine. I don't care. But I'm pleading with you. Connect with other Christians. If God is real, and you want his power in your life, you have got to connect with other Christians. As strong as you are, you cannot do it alone. And you were not made to do it alone. We've created some environments to help things along. But you're going to have to do something. You're going to have to do something. We can't do it. I can't read your Bible for you. I can't make friends for you. We can provide Bible resources for you, but you still got to read for yourself. We can create connection opportunities for you, but you still have to take a step somewhere. I know that's scary. Have you prayed about it with anybody else? And then as God answers, have you given God the praise? Remember, as Daniel's prayers are being answered, he immediately gave all praise to God, and the Babylonian Empire paid attention. What do you think can happen in our culture if Christians stand up to do the right thing, step forward regardless of the risk, and then give God all the glory for it? Do you think that might make the nightly news every now and again? Might be hard on the nightly news. Because, yeah, I know we like to report all the bad things and not the good things. But somebody's going to notice. Give God the praise for the things that he's doing in your life. Tell somebody what God's been doing in you. So let's take just a moment, kind of apply it to our own life. So your problem, have you prayed about it? Your problem, have you shared it with anyone? Your problem, do you know that God is there to help you? A God who shapes history is there to help you. So what are you so worked up about? As the band comes up, I do need to ask one other question, because one of the things that we realize in moments like this too is, you know, as much as we know that's what we're supposed to do, myself included, there are far too many times I just don't do it. I don't know what it is that gets dislodged in my little brain. You know, you face a problem, you go, oh, I guess it's up to me then. Face a problem, oh, I guess I better work harder then. Face a problem, oh, I better worry about that more. And yes, you are called to do something about it. Yes, you are called to engage. But as your resources come to its limit, you're just at the very beginning of what God is able to do. So I dare you. I dare you. Take it to God today. And if you're having one of those repentant moments like I find myself in when I hear messages like this, I realize I haven't. I've been ignoring God. Even if I know him, I've been ignoring God. And I need to, before I even take the problem to the Lord, I need to say, God, I need you in my life. I don't want to have you just on the sidelines like an ornament on a tree or a decoration on my wall. I need you in my heart. I need you in every moment of every day. And God, I'm sorry I haven't. Forgive me. See, one of the great things about being a Christian is we know that because of what Jesus accomplished on the cross, that every time we lean back on that sacrifice, we experience his salvation in fresh ways. I mean, the moment that you confessed your sin and you gave it over to the Lord, that moment, you became a child of God. That moment, the entire slate was washed clean. That moment, everything that stands between you and the Father was taken away. And we can know because of what Jesus did on that cross that God is good. And he loves you and me and us. And even though life may suggest things radically different, God has good intentions for you. And our whole life is in his hands. So if that's you and you feel like you've been just keeping God at arm's length, today could be a turnaround day. Today could be the moment that you come back. So with every head bowed, with every eye closed, let's just take a moment and pray. God, thank you that even when we ignore you, we turn our backs on you, you have never, ever turned your back on us. That the moment that we confess our sin and recognize our need, you meet us there with grace. Thank you, God, that in every situation that we experience, that you are greater than the stress. You are greater than the pressure. You are greater than the fear. And what you can accomplish is greater than anything we could ever accomplish. So Lord, help us to do what we can, but Lord, to leave the rest to you. And so God, I just want to pray for my friends here today, even as I pray for myself. God, we give you our pressures. We give you our fears. We give you our impossible situations. Maybe just even as a congregation, as an act of worship to that, if you're giving him an impossible or a humanly impossible situation today, would you just lift up your hand? God, we're giving it to you. See those hands around the room? God, we are giving it to you. God, you are capable. God, you can do things we could never do. We're giving it over to you. We're going to trust you. We're going to worship you. We're going to ask you for the answers. We're going to ask you for the strength. When we're going to give you all the praise. Because God, you are good.